You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, the USDA recently put out its latest agriculture census. We'll talk about what it shows about organic farming in Wisconsin and a big rise in the number of dairy goats in the state. First, new figures from the Wisconsin Department of Tourism show that people are continuing to spend big bucks to have fun in the state. According to the Economic Impact of Tourism in Wisconsin report, tourist spending topped $13 billion in 2018. That's up nearly 5% from the previous year. It also marked the ninth straight year that tourism spending increased. Sarah Meany is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Secretary appointee Meany, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, there's been reporting on the latest numbers. Looks like the tourism industry is in pretty good shape. What do you suppose is behind that in Wisconsin?
Well, it's always great to see continued steady growth. So at $21.6 billion in economic impact in the state, we're pretty happy to see that trend continue. What we do know is that certainly areas of the state have seen growing levels of activity and interest. We did see that 26% of that total economic impact comes out of the state's largest city, Milwaukee, with quite a few large events certainly happening in 2018. We can never forget, of course, Harley-Davidson's five-year anniversary celebration that brings many, many people in. But that is not alone the one thing that contributes to that growth. It's a statewide effort, and we see regions across the state also buoying those numbers and seeing growth throughout the state.
What does this all mean in terms of jobs here in the state?
So, you know, along with the economic impact, we've also seen an increase in jobs related to tourism and sustained by tourism. So that number is also up. Nearly 200,000 jobs in the state are sustained by tourism, and the number is actually 199,073. And that number is also up over 2017. So it's good to see job creation as a result of continued success and growth throughout the state. But we also have to keep in mind that, you know, we need to continue to attract workers and retain workers as they graduate or come visit the state and want to stay here.
What does this look like in terms of in-state versus out-of-state? Is most of our tourism, we go from point A to point B within Wisconsin, or are we luring a lot of visitors in across the borders?
That's a great question. It's actually a fair mix of both. Wisconsinites do enjoy traveling within Wisconsin, and that is a target market of ours at the Department of Tourism. We definitely market to Wisconsinites to spread their wings and see other parts of the state. But we also see a large amount of people coming by personal vehicle. Actually, we're very dependent on the driving market from the neighboring states. Chicago is a really large feeder market for us, as is Minneapolis-St. Paul, Northeast Iowa, parts of Missouri, and Michigan. So, but we do see a lovely number coming internationally, but we really want to see those numbers grow. We also have high expectations for growth in the future, and we expect to look further afield and potentially to direct flight markets to bring people into our airport cities as gateways to the rest of the state.
We're talking to Sarah Meany, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, about Wisconsin's tourism economy and its future. Sarah, you've been quoted, forgive me if I'm not getting this exactly right, but you say we could be kicking a lot more butt in Wisconsin when it comes to our tourism.
Yes, one of my shining moments of ad-lib speaking. No, and I mean every word of it. You know, what's great is we have a really strong foundation. Wisconsin is an excellent destination. The department and the tourism industry throughout the state have done great work for many years, and that steady growth is a testament to that. But we also know that with tweaking and additional strategic planning, we can grow in markets that we haven't necessarily completely kicked all the butts yet, so to speak. We do anticipate that we can see growth and want to see growth in younger travelers. Certainly millennials know through experience that Wisconsin is a great place, not just to visit, but also to work here and to raise a family. But we do rely very heavily on the older traveler as our visitor base. So we expect to be working hard to attract more younger visitors and a more diverse visitor base as well. We know that we have you know, an offering that appeals to so many people from so many walks of life. We just need to do more intentional work and authentic work to make sure that we get the message out. And then another opportunity for growth really is those direct flight markets. You know, Milwaukee and Madison and other regional airports have a lot of direct flights from many cities around the country. With additional investment, of course, marketing costs money. With additional investment in the tourism campaigns that we have planned, we do anticipate being able to pull people from much further afield. In fact, just today I got a message on Facebook from a visitor from Germany who's in Wisconsin for the month, and he just can't understand why more people in Germany and Western Europe don't go to Wisconsin more. So I think he's right. I think we have an incredible tourism product and have all the reasons why people should come visit. So we're going to be working hard to get the word out and build awareness.
If I can get a bit travel wonky now, you've focused on, I know, not just how many people are coming in, but how much, how many dollars are being spent per tourist a day. How do we start to drive that number up to make sure that we're getting as much economic impact out of each tourist we possibly can?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, you know, it's a complex equation, actually. But the more mature each of our destination markets becomes, the more opportunities people have to leave their money behind when they visit Wisconsin. So what we saw is, we saw a nice 1.9% increase in total visitors to the state in 2018 over 2017. That was about 1.9% increase, 112 million people. Those people per person spend was higher, noticeably higher. And that obviously means that people are finding more reasons to stay longer and spend more money on recreation. Now, the recreation sector within the tourism economy saw the largest amount of growth at over 8%. So compare that to food and lodging and other sectors within the industry. That's a great indication that people want to come to Wisconsin to play. They want to come and have a really good time. And outdoor recreation plays an important piece of that too. So the longer people stay, the more overnights that we can get people to commit to, the more dollars get left behind in our state. So we see outdoor recreation not only as a growing opportunity, but also a really strong existing platform from which to build. So we see a lot of opportunity in that area. And that also explains why that's a focus area of the governor's proposed budget. We've heard great feedback on that throughout the industry and on both sides of the aisle, politically, frankly, because tourism is neither red nor green. It's neither red nor blue. It's actually green. Everyone's dollars contribute to that economic impact.
I wanted to ask a little more about the state budget. A lot going on there. What do you see as the key points when it comes to tourism spending in the state?
Well, we're excited by the support and feedback we've gotten from all over the state. The governor has proposed an increase in the tourism budget of $5.1 million over the biennium. What that means to us, we currently have $15.5 million a year to spend in tourism, marketing, and advertising. But when you contrast that to our neighboring states to the east and west, may they go unnamed at the moment, we are way behind in terms of dollars available. So it makes it really hard to stay competitive because it is those states themselves that are targeting our own citizens to visit outside the state. So we know that the jobs in tourism themselves are very important. We know the economic impact is important, and we don't want to see those numbers slip as competition continues to heat up. And trust me, it is. The strategic plans from our neighboring states definitely have Wisconsin in their sights, and we want to make sure that we can remain competitive and keep more of those dollars and growth opportunities within the state of Wisconsin.
Speaking of opportunities, you mentioned the role of events a little bit earlier. I want to key in on one coming up next year, the Democratic National Convention coming to Milwaukee. Looking ahead to that, how do you want to make sure that we get the best out of that we can as a state?
Yeah, it goes without saying that the event itself, of course, is expected to have significant economic impact on the days that all those people are in town in southeastern Wisconsin. But as far as we see it statewide, the opportunity is much greater than that. It's an unprecedented opportunity where the world is watching Wisconsin and Milwaukee, and certainly the national media will be paying more attention than they have in a long time to what's going on here in Wisconsin. So I think that's a huge opportunity that we are already making plans and efforts to take advantage of. We have really great stories to tell here in Wisconsin, and the national media isn't necessarily fully up to speed with all the things to talk about. So we're going to be working hard in the months leading up to that convention to make sure people have the right things to talk about and the most updated things to talk about so that people's impressions and understanding of what it is to be from Wisconsin, what it actually means, and increase that interest. Now, you know, the DNC isn't the only big event in 2020. The Ryder Cup, of course, a huge golf event, will also be bringing many, many, many people to the area to focus on that incredible international golf event. But those dollars get left behind throughout the state. You know, people don't just fly into an airport and show up at one place. They spend dollars and money in all of the local economies along the way. And we have plans to entice people to want to spend a few days on either end of that incredible golf experience in the surrounding areas and throughout the state as well. So big events like that, of course, make a big jump in visitation during those days. But really, it puts Milwaukee and it puts Wisconsin on the map in a new way and helps people redefine what they think about Wisconsin as a destination. So we are going to do everything we can to take advantage of that.
We'll leave it there for now. Secretary Designee Meany, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Sarah Meany is the secretary appointee of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We talked through about the agency's annual economic report, which came out this week. It shows that more than $13 billion was spent by tourists in Wisconsin in 2018. Coming up, we'll talk about changes the USDA has made to the way it counts farmers in Wisconsin and why those mean that more women are being represented. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, House Democrats are fighting the Trump administration on a variety of investigations and subpoenas. We'll get the latest during our look at the week in Washington. First, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is out with its latest farm census, and there's a handful of interesting trends taking shape in Wisconsin. Our next guest went through all of the data and rounded up the highlights in a piece you can find online at wiscontext.org. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. Will, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one big story here, more women counted in this agricultural census as farmers. What's the story there?
Yeah, so the operative word there is counted.
Right.
The census made some changes in 2017. They got some feedback from previous censuses that they were not necessarily counting all of the decision makers at farms. So they expanded the number of producers that could be counted per farm, as well as the number of primary decision makers. And so, in consequence, they counted a lot more women.
And it sounds like there were more counted, and we're going to talk about this with another guest in just a few. There may actually also be more women getting into farming. That might be hard to tease out, though, from the numbers.
Yes, exactly. I think it'll be clearer once the next census comes around and we have two sets of data with the new questions to compare. But yeah, I think there very likely could also be a real increase in women farmers in the state.
Another issue we've talked about a lot on the show is the aging demographic of farmers. So we see more older farmers, fewer younger farmers over time. What does this new census tell us about that?
Aging is continuing. It's actually accelerating. Now, I think one in three Wisconsin farmers is over the age of 65. Up until fairly recently, it was more like one in five. But on the flip side, there are more younger farmers counted for the first time since like the 1970s. So farmers younger than 35, which is kind of cool.
That's an uptick, but not enough to shift the scales with that big number you mentioned, one in three over 65.
Right. It was an uptick, but just it was pretty minor compared to the overall trends.
And one big increase, Wisconsin is a big organic farming state. I think people know that by now. What have we seen in this latest census now?
Organic farming continues to be big in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has the second most number of organic farms in the country, so still in that second place spot behind California. The number of farms is now over 1,500. And I think the bigger story, though, is that the income on those organic farms more than doubled in 5 years.
And you wrote in your piece, there are some states that have fewer farms but make more money, but they're doing higher cost products. A lot of our organic here is dairy, which costs more than non-organic dairy, still not a big money item.
Right. Some of those other states with fewer farms but more organic sales or higher sales are Washington, Oregon, places that make a lot of organic or produce a lot of organic apples and other fruits that are just higher value.
And then another story, more goats.
Yeah, a lot more goats. Particularly dairy goats. So the number of dairy goats has been on the rise in Wisconsin over the last 25 years or so, but it really exploded in the 5 years between 2012 and 2017, up over 60%. There are now over 88,000 dairy goats in the state, and they're concentrated in just a few counties, mostly in the southwest part of the state, but also around Green Bay and elsewhere.
It's, and apparently connected to more demand for goat milk straight up and goat milk cheese.
Yes, goat cheese is big, as I think a lot of listeners probably can attest to. And there is actually a processor that is looking at expanding their plant in Lancaster that could make it the largest such plant in the country.
And part two of the story, you're going to go out and do some sampling, I hope?
I really hope so.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Will Cushman from WisContext. Now we take a closer look at two of these trends with Lisa Kivrist. She runs the In Her Boots Project, a network for women in organic farming. That's part of the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service, known as MOSES. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
Well, let's start with that trend of more women in farming. I know you work with a lot of women farmers around the state. What are you seeing on the ground?
We definitely see more women interested in starting farms, bottom line. Our In Her Boots attendance at various workshops and conferences has increased. And what's interesting is we see a real diversity of women in ages, for example. We see a lot of women midlife coming to our sessions who we call encore farmers, starting that encore career, but maybe they're returning to their family farm or starting something new. But people from all backgrounds, women from all sectors who are finding their passion in organic farming here in Wisconsin.
And as I talked to Will there, the USDA is changing the way it counts farmers. That'll demonstrate the number of farmers they hope a little more accurately. What are your hopes for that, the way they change that farm census?
Most definitely. And kudos to the USDA for recognizing that we have a diverse and changing farming population, and people are farming in new ways, new partnerships, and we want to reflect that in the census data because, most importantly, and the reason why we have the census is that drives policy, and policy drives dollars and support, and it's something that all farmers need to be counted in, and particularly organic farmers where we don't fit the traditional boxes and we don't fit the check boxes of how many, you know, hundreds of acres of corn or alfalfa. And the USDA importantly recognizes that and is evolving the census to reflect our farming base.
Let's turn to that organic side of the story now. We've seen, according to the census, continued growth in the number of organic farms in the state. What's behind that?
What's behind that? It's a great question because we have to look back a couple of decades. So organizations like MOSES, the Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Service, started 30 years ago with the conference of bringing together, at the time, a very small, they could probably fit around the table, number of farmers who were farming organically. But it's because of our roots in Wisconsin in organics and our commitment to growing that base and that real collaborative sharing of knowledge amongst organic farmers that we see these numbers that we see today. You know, it's not something brand new and hot. It's due to the fact that entities like MOSES and our whole community have been at this for a long time.
As we just talked about with Will, we are number two in the country when it comes to the number of organic farms. Only California, big, big California, is ahead of us.
Slightly larger growing season. We'll take two. It's okay.
So what is it that made Wisconsin in particular such a big state when it comes to the number of organic certified farms?
It is, again, the history, the resources. There isn't a better time to become an organic farmer in Wisconsin than now. There is entities like Moses and organizations to tap into to get you started, and importantly, a growing consumer base. You also see that in the census data that sales of organics in Wisconsin grew over 100% since the last census. So it's driven by consumer demand of people increasingly wanting to know their farmer and where it came from and how it was grown. So it's all those factors combined that are driving these numbers.
You mentioned resources, Lisa. What is out there for someone who's either thinking of starting a new farm and they want it to be organic, or somebody who's thinking of converting all or part of a current operation into a certified organic farm?
You bet. Well, there's two things. There's a lot of organizations, again, like the Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Service, resources through UW Extension and the Department of Agriculture through DATCAP to help connect with the information you need. And also, and importantly, it's other farmers. And Moses cultivates a lot of this throughout the summer with a whole variety of field days. We do In Her Boots sessions with women in ag. And these are on-farm sessions where anybody can come. It's your first ag event ever. Welcome. And if you have this dream of starting a farm, it's time to get started, because there are ways to connect directly with other farmers. And that's that collaborative spirit, particularly amongst organic farmers that I see at the gatherings I work at, where there's a real passion to share what you've learned and to support other new farmers in particular.
And one point of this survey that surprised me, I just wanted to ask if you've seen it on the ground. We're getting more and more goats, dairy goats here in Wisconsin. The farmers you work with, are you seeing that with them?
Women love goats, you bet. Probably because they're adorable, but also because they are a strategic part of your business for cheese, for milk, for soap. For agritourism, it's a lot of different factors can come out of the goats, and it's great to see. It's, a changing agricultural base, and you definitely see that. I see that amongst the women in our Inner Boots program of looking at things differently, and it's not same old, same old. How can we advance agriculture, do things differently, and support Wisconsin at the same time?
We'll leave it there. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lisa Kivirist, founder of the In Her Boots Project with Moses. She was with us today to talk about more women being counted in the USDA's latest agricultural census and growth in Wisconsin's organic farming sector. Moses is the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. You can find out more about all of the trends outlined in that new USDA report. It's over at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, the president is invoking executive privilege to block the release of the unredacted Mueller report. We'll look at the latest on that standoff with Congress in our weekly roundup of national news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a committee in the State Assembly debated a set of bills about abortion yesterday. We'll talk about what they would do and what Governor Evers has said about their prospects. First, we take our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. It's been a week of conflict between House Democrats and the White House on a few different fronts. Congressional committees are seeking President Trump's tax returns, the unredacted Mueller report, and have voted to hold the attorney general in contempt after he refused to comply with the terms of a hearing with lawmakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democrats in Congress should get to look at the president's tax returns or the full version of the Mueller report? What do you think about these conflicts over investigations and subpoenas? What do you think they're showing about the balance of power in our government? And do you agree with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell when he says Congress should move on from the Mueller investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into specific items, Amanda, there's this conflict between House Democrats and the White House over basically all the stuff, right?
Right, over everything. And so far, the White House has not complied with any of the House Democrats' subpoenas or demands. And this is making Democrats pretty angry, including ones who weren't necessarily in favor of going down the road of impeachment, are now starting to say, look, it looks like we might not have any more choice. It seems Trump is sort of goading us into this, but, you know, the stakes have been raised considerably now.
Now, we have this latest news. The House Judiciary Committee voted just this afternoon to hold Attorney General Bill Barr in contempt of Congress. What's this all about?
Right. This happened just a few minutes ago. It was a party line vote of 24-16. And House Democrats wanted Bill Barr, the attorney general, to hand over the full Mueller report, not the redacted version the public saw, but the full version and the underlying materials. The Justice Department said no. It offered a slightly less redacted version to a group of lawmakers, but they didn't want to comply and hand over everything. Democrats still wanted it. And so Trump, at the request of Bill Barr, invoked executive privilege, which is something the president can do, simply saying that, you know, this is privileged material and releasing it would get in the way of me doing my job and my constitutional duties, or we're not going to give it to you. And so Democrats voted to hold Bill Barr in contempt today.
Now, this is just a committee. Does the whole House have to vote then to do that, to have contempt actually be the real deal?
Yes. Right now, it's just the committee. It's expected to go to the floor. It's expected to pass because Democrats have a majority there. But, you know, what happens after that? I mean, you know, Congress, you know, in theory, defying a congressional subpoena is a misdemeanor crime. You can get 1 to 12 months in jail. But I mean, who's going to carry that out? Congress doesn't really have like a law enforcement arm. And they historically can use something called inherent contempt authority to detain someone, but they haven't tried to do this since 1935. They can order the Justice Department to go after someone for in court. Ignores them, it ignores a court order, but the Justice Department can also say, like, simply, we're not going to do that. So it really doesn't look like holding someone in contempt has much force of law, but it is symbolic. It is only the second time, I believe, that this has happened with the attorney general, but where this will likely end up is in the courts to try to get the Trump administration to hand this over.
Also possibly headed to the courts, former White House lawyer Don McGahn was ordered by the executive branch to not comply with a subpoena from the Judiciary Committee to turn over documents and testify. What are the Democrats hoping to hear from him after he played a big role in the Mueller report?
Well, this is all about obstruction of justice and whether Trump obstructed justice, because Robert Mueller obviously left that question more open. And Don McGahn, basically, his role in this is supposedly that Trump told him to get rid of Robert Mueller, and McGahn refused. And then supposedly there was a New York Times story that came out about this, and Trump wanted McGahn to correct the record and put in writing something for their internal records or to release to the public that the New York Times story is false. And so there's a question of whether was the story false and Trump simply wanted to correct the record, or was he trying to create a paper trail that obscured what actually happened, which further indicates that he was trying to obstruct justice? And so that is why Democrats want to hear from Don McGahn. What did Trump order you to do exactly with regards to Robert Mueller and, you know, sort of rewriting the record of history?
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post, looking at some of the big news in national politics. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Want to give a listen, though, to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He says he's fed up with these investigations going on the other side of the of Capitol Hill. Here's what he had to say about the Mueller report earlier this week.
They told everyone there'd been a conspiracy between Russia and the Trump campaign. Yet on this central question, the special counsel's finding is clear. Case closed.
He said, time to wrap up talking about the Mueller report. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, though, had this to say in response to McConnell.
So our leader says, let's move on. It's sort of like Richard Nixon saying, let's move on at the height of the investigation of his wrongdoing. Of course, he wants to move on. He wants to cover up. He wants to silence on one of the most serious issues we face.
So, Amanda, Republican leader in the Senate saying enough's enough. Top Senate Democrat saying, why, Congress, are you trying to stop this? Or why, McConnell, are you trying to stop this? What's the latest on the Senate side of things here?
Well, you know, this isn't really going to go anywhere in the Senate. But, you know, I will say in terms of Bill Barr, you don't really need both branches of Congress to declare someone in contempt. So House Democrats can do this on their own. You know, that's why a lot of people say pursuing impeachment isn't useful, because you would need the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, to go along with it. But House, you know, on the House side, that's where the power is. Democrats control it. They can do these investigations on their own. You're not seeing much in the Senate, because you have Mitch McConnell there, who is defending Trump because he wants, you know, to pass judges, to get judges through, and to, you know, protect this Republican agenda.
Let's bring our callers in now at 800-642-1234. Charlie starts us off in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. This morning, The Hill reported that Kathleen Kavlicek of the FBI met with Daniel Steele prior to any FISA warrants and noted that Daniel Steele had a political agenda and that his report was not to be believed. The question that I had then, or comment from your guest, is that it appears that from the word go, that this was a quote-unquote trumped-up situation. And as such, isn't the case closed? Shouldn't we move onward, and shouldn't we compromise to do what's right for the country rather than focus on more division and more things that are wrong?
Charlie, thanks for the call. And that's the argument we're hearing from Republicans, from Mitch McConnell and the president, of course, on down, Amanda.
Sure. And I think that's why some Democrats are a little nervous about going forward with something like impeachment, because it is so divisive and may turn off people who may not even like President Trump that much. But, you know, in terms of the case being closed, I think what Democrats are saying is that it's not. Robert Mueller's, you know, did the most thorough investigation of this. And whether Trump obstructed justice or not, he basically left it in Congress's hands to determine that. And he said he didn't come to a conclusion on obstruction of justice because he didn't feel like it was his job to. Now, Attorney General Bill Barr did, and he cleared Trump of that. But I don't think Democrats buy that, because Bill Barr was handpicked by Trump to be attorney general and has shown himself to be someone who basically is defending Trump at all costs. So Democrats are taking sort of what the Mueller report says and saying it's now up to us to pursue this further, to take what Mueller has, investigate it more, and it's for us to make the determination of whether Trump obstructed justice.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. Mike joins us now in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing? Yeah, my opinion is that Democrats should not pursue impeachment at this point in time. I think they ought to go after the Senate. And they only need 3 or 4 seats. I would put my attention there and my money and all of my energy, instead of having 22 people running for the presidency. Once they have the Senate, Trump does not have any backup. Mitch McConnell will be gone, and then you can pursue impeachment, and we can get to the bottom of the entire Mueller investigation, the Russian thing, and the whole shot.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll get into that presidential field in a little bit. But at least in a lot of popular opinion, a lot of people are with Mike and saying don't pursue impeachment, at least for now. But a lot of people seem to be open to further investigations. Is that what you're seeing, Amanda?
Yes, that's it. That seems to be the position of Democrats. I mean, a lot of Democrats are very nervous about, you know, looking at what happened to Republicans when they pursued impeachment of Bill Clinton in the following midterm elections. They didn't really do all that well. And Clinton remained incredibly popular. And the public were disgusted with Republicans going after him so aggressively. And so Democrats are very nervous about that happening this time. You have other Democrats saying, look, we have a responsibility to do this. I think Democrats are getting frustrated by Trump because it's like he's ignoring everything we say. He's ignoring our demands, our requests, our subpoenas, and we're supposed to be a co-equal branch of government. So if we don't actually stand up for ourselves and do something, we look weak and we're weakening the institution. So, you know, politically, impeachment may not be the right thing for Democrats and may harm them. But again, I think there are some people who are saying that morally and just for the institution, it's where we need to go. But I would say that you're right, that right now, most Democrats are not in Congress, are not on the impeachment train, and just want more investigations.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, looking at the week's top news from the nation's capital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Democrats should be, as they are, pursuing things like the president's tax returns or the full Mueller report, the unredacted version? What do you think comes of all of this? Should Congress focus on other stuff? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, hear more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post, looking at the week's big political news. Back to some of your calls on the standoff between Democrats in the U.S. House and the White House. Marcia is with us in Dodgeville. Marcia, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I would prefer they turn their attention to actually doing the business of the government. And I've heard enough, and I'm absolutely fed up. Both sides, absolutely fed up.
All right, Marcia, thanks a lot for the call. There was a meeting between President Trump and Democratic leaders working on an infrastructure plan, Amanda, that would try to do kind of what she said, even while all this stuff's going on, try to do some of the business. Do you think anything's coming out of that infrastructure deal they tentatively arrived at?
Honestly, not really. Infrastructure is something that seems to come up every now and then. Trump has expressed interest in infrastructure. Democrats and Republicans say they want it too. I mean, for good reason. The nation's infrastructure, roads, bridges, and all that are crumbling and desperately need repair, and it would create a lot of jobs. And it's just something that needs to be done. And it's something that basically only the federal government can, you know, the government can do. But, you know, Trump and Democrats, you know, aren't in the same place on what sort of deal they would want and what sort of deal would look like. And like right now, it just doesn't seem like much is going to get through Congress. So I wouldn't put a lot of hope in something happening anytime soon. And as you've seen in the past, Trump and Democrats seem to have meetings, seem to reach a deal, and then Trump will change his mind for some reason or back out. And, you know, so no, unfortunately, not right now.
Thanks for that call. Tom joins us in Port Wing now. Tom, hi.
Hi. I think all of this is a fool's errand of directing all this stuff into the courts. And the Trump administration knows that. And if the Democrats go into 2020 with nothing accomplished, they will have played directly into the president's hands.
Tom, thanks for the call. I've seen this argument, and I think Nancy Pelosi said something like the president used the word goaded earlier, and I think she did too, is trying to goad Democrats into impeachment, thinking that that ultimately benefits him.
Yes. I mean, Pelosi all along has been not in favor of impeachment, and she's trying to keep her members who want impeachment happy that maybe she's open to it, but also she doesn't want to seem to be encouraging it. You know, if it does go to the courts, it could be tied up there for a really long time, and I don't think you're going to see any resolution anytime soon, and that's probably just fine for the White House because they can just sort of wait this out. But Pelosi and Democratic leaders are trying very hard to say, look, we're focusing on, for example, these economic issues and these issues that people say they care about. But, you know, we'll see how much the base gets upset. And I mean, you know, what really does animate the Democratic base is getting rid of Trump. They don't all agree on how to do that. But if Trump continues to defy Congress, you know, the mood might change a little bit.
Thanks a lot for all your calls on that. I want to move on to a couple other issues. One last point of conflict. I assume it's not the last, actually, Amanda, but President Trump's tax returns, the House Ways and Means Committee looking for recent tax returns. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says, nope. What's the status of that standoff right now?
Once again, this is probably something that will end up in the courts. Right now, they've requested them. Mnuchin said no. The next step is actually probably a subpoena. I'm assuming that the Trump administration won't comply with that, and it could go to the courts. But, you know, Congress, there is a law that says Congress can request the tax returns of anyone. And, you know, this has never happened. And they've done this fairly regularly, but they've never requested the tax returns of a president because every president has released their tax returns voluntarily since Richard Nixon. So this is incredibly unprecedented. And again, I expect the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, to continue to deny Democratic demands. And the New York Times obviously put out a story yesterday for a 10-year period, just sort of showing the big picture that Trump lost quite a bit of money during this 10-year period. But, you know, I don't think we'll be seeing them probably anytime soon.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post, looking at the big stories in national politics. Want to turn over to the 2020 presidential primary. You've written about this some, Amanda. Candidates, including most recently Senator Bernie Sanders, releasing their plans on agricultural policy. What kind of things are we hearing from Senator Sanders and others?
Well, there's a lot of focus, and we went to Iowa and we hosted a 2020 forum in Storm Lake, Iowa. And we talked to some of the presidential candidates, and separately I interviewed Bernie Sanders about sort of corporate power in the agribusiness sector. There's been increased consolidation, vertical integration, and it's just really hard for family farmers to sort of break out of this, to get sort of labor rights and to just, you know, basically eke out a living and get better wages and survival. And so Bernie Sanders has called for a moratorium on agriculture mergers. And that's something that Elizabeth Warren also supports. Cory Booker has supported that. I had asked Senator Amy Klobuchar if she supported that, and she said she wanted to take it more case by case. But in general, what all these candidates have in common is that they just want more oversight of corporate mergers in the agribusiness industry so that you don't get these conglomerates controlling such a large portion of the market as we see in the poultry industry.
And on messaging, it seems like they're taking the candidates you mentioned, their message of, you know, against the big guy in favor of the little guy that they may have applied to, you know, Wall Street banks and others. And they're looking to bring that to have a rural related message that fits their overall theme.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, it's interesting to see that these candidates going into rural America and not necessarily feeling like they have to go to the middle, that they're still going with this sort of populist or progressive message of, like you said, taking on big corporations, but being like, look, it's affecting you in these rural areas as well.
So staying with this field of now over 20 Democratic candidates, do you have a sense of a timeline when you think this might start to narrow? Or, I don't know, are more people waiting in the wings? We're going to end up at 30.
I don't know. There might be more people coming in. I don't know about that. But I think we have the big people in by now who are going to be the front runners. Where you'll probably see things start to change is after the first debate in June, because – you know, you're going to have two nights of debates and the candidates are going to be on the stage sort of randomly. So it won't be all the front runners one night and all the lower tier candidates the next night. Everyone's going to be mixed up. And then you'll really see the candidates maybe start to go after each other a little bit. You'll see them head to head distinguish themselves on policy, who seems like they could be on a stage with President Trump in a way that they could win. And so I think that's when, you know, candidates then see a surge of support, extra fundraising, and where the field will change a little bit.
What do you see just in our last couple of minutes about how candidates are trying to distinguish themselves from each other now? What leaps out at you at this stage in the game?
Well, you know, there are candidates, if you're, you know, someone like Elizabeth Warren, for example, you're trying to do that with policy. She's releasing a ton of detailed policy proposals and trying to be the candidate who sort of has a plan for everything. But then there are other candidates who, you know, you see, but what every candidate is doing is sort of electability. And so that's Warren's way of like, you know, I have these solutions. I have a plan that I think will appeal to people. Other people are saying, like Joe Biden, you know, I can win back voters who went for Trump in Midwestern states. You see other people like Cory Booker saying that I can sort of rebuild the Obama coalition and bring people together. You know, Senator Kamala Harris saying that she can win over a lot of women and black voters who are sort of the backbone of the Democratic Party. So every candidate is trying to pitch themselves as the most electable. I guess it's sort of what you think, what you sort of you prioritize and what you think is actually the most effective way to do it. If you're looking at the Midwest, is it bringing back some of those Trump voters into the Democratic Party, or is it going after a lot of those voters of color who just stayed home in 2016 and didn't vote for Hillary Clinton?
We'll leave it there. Amanda, thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She was with us for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national politics. still time for you to share your thoughts on our big question this week. What do you think of the standoff between Democrats in the U.S. House and the White House? Should the White House release the president's tax returns? Should they release the full unredacted Mueller report to members of Congress? Should the attorney general testify in front of the House and other people they've subpoenaed? And how about Robert Mueller himself? Are you curious to see what he would say before Congress? You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Yesterday, we talked to Eric Gorges from the PBS show A Craftsman's Legacy about the value of working with our hands. A lot of you called in and some more of you have emailed. Here are some of your stories. We'll see how many I can share here. Sarah writes, I didn't think I was ever good at construction until 2 years ago. I took on building our first chicken coop. I used and read lots of books and coop examples, but I needed to put my hands on the wood and tools to figure it out. I needed to make mistakes and learn how to solve them. I'm currently working, she writes, on our second coop now and have completed a workbench, a shed, and various home projects in the past 2 years since. I'm hooked. What to build next is always on my mind. That's great, Sarah. We heard from Don. Don says, I worked in IT for years and taught information systems at UWEC. I retired early to create functional art using reclaimed materials. I now build lamps, sculptures, tables, and clocks using these reclaimed and discarded items. Jenny in Milwaukee tells us, I work in public education policy, which seems like work that's always evolving, being undone, redone, revisited. I sometimes get an urge, Jenny says, to create something like a craft or an art project as a means to have something that has a clear beginning and a distinct end. Art lets me have a finished project. And Alex in Brookfield says, I picked up guitar at age 25. I can't carry a tune in a bucket, but learning new songs, especially complex songs, has become a hobby and a passion for me. Now, Alex says, I'd like to learn how to build guitars. Well, thank you so much for those stories. You can keep telling us about your projects, what you work on at Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is the Ideas Network.